We're speaking with Peter Kuznick, co-author with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States, companion to the 10-part Showtime film series of the same title. Peter Kuznick is a professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University and is currently serving his third term as distinguished lecturer with the Organization of American Historians. His previous books include Rethinking Cold War Culture, Beyond the Laboratory, Scientists as Political Activists in 1930s America, and two books out in Japanese, Rethinking the Atomic Bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and From Hiroshima to Fukushima. Thanks so much for joining us today, Peter.
Hi, Scott. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on the book and the film series. I think you certainly broke a lot of new ground to a major audience across the country. And I would like to just first ask you how you and Oliver Stone came to conceptualize this project, which is enormous, trying to cover 20th century American history in this 10-part series. And of course, in this book we're talking about. But maybe you could talk about the impetus. How did this come together?
Well, it actually had its roots back in 1996. I was introducing a new course at American University, a history course titled Oliver Stone's America, which we were using Oliver's movies in order to get at the key events in post-war U.S. history. So we began with JFK, then we did his Vietnam trilogy, then we went on to the Doors movie to deal with 60s counterculture, and we did films like Salvador and Wall Street and W, and later we added W. But his films actually are very effective for getting at debates about post-war U.S. history. Then I would bring in guest speakers who were involved in those events, people like Robert McNamara and Bob Woodward and Dan Ellsberg and Vietnam vets. And we'd also read books by scholars that presented alternative points of view. And Oliver came into class as a guest speaker that first semester, and after the class we went out to dinner, and I said to him that I had an idea for a movie that he's got to make, and I laid out my ideas about Henry Wallace and the atomic bombings, the origins of the Cold War, and Oliver said, "Peter, that's a brilliant idea, let's do it." But it was over dinner, we were having a good time, but he went back to L.A. the next day and called me up and said, "He's serious, let's really do this." So we ended up trying to do that. I wrote the screenplay. We never got that one made, but we stayed close friends, and he'd come into class every semester when he could, whenever I taught it. It was a very, very popular class. And then he was coming to town to scout locations for his film Pinkville in 2007, a film he was going to make about the My Lai massacre. And he was here for a day, and he asked if I could join him for dinner, and it was with Oliver and his producer and his cinematographer, and we started over dinner talking about history and politics, as we always do. And he said, "Let's do it. Let's do a documentary dealing with the origins of the Cold War and Wallace and Hiroshima." And it was going to be a 60 or 90-minute documentary, one shot. He asked me to meet him in New York 2 weeks later. By the time I got there, it was now a 10-part documentary film series. So the idea had expanded. The first one I thought I could handle easily during my sabbatical year. The project ended up taking 5 years before it was finally made. And we ended up making 12 episodes. We showed 10 of them on Showtime. The other two are going to be included in the box set that we release this summer. So we're going from the late 19th century all the way to the second Obama administration. It's right up to the present. And it's an enormous project. About two-thirds of the way into the documentary writing, we decided to add the book. And with the support and help of my colleagues and about 8 of my PhD students helping as researchers, we ended up writing an 800-page book that we got out to coincide with the release of the documentary film series. And even there, we had to cut out 150 pages in order to make it liftable for readers. So there's so much to tell. We try to do as much as we can in the documentaries, and we expand on that, develop those ideas further in the book. So we hope that people both watch the documentaries and read the book, and between the two of them, they'll begin to, they won't have an exhaustive understanding yet of the untold history of the United States, but it will spark enough interest and raise enough questions that we hope people will go on and do further research and reading in order to develop a better understanding of what U.S. history really has been and what it could have been and what we hope it will become.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. It's a fascinating chronology of how that came about, and an enormous amount of work to actually put together this, as you said, a 12-part series, actually, and the book together over 5 years. I've heard that the film was modeled in some way on World at War, which I grew up watching, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen World at War, about World War II, with all the documentary footage and the narration. It's similar in some ways. Was that an influence of how this came together, at least as far as the film series?
Yes, probably more in Oliver's mind than mine. The kinds of things that I was doing were what I've been teaching my students at American University for two decades now. But it's interesting because there was a confluence between my understanding and Oliver's understanding. Whenever Oliver's asked about this, he says that he didn't come back from Vietnam with an entirely new radical perspective and an anti-war attitude. He said he developed this slowly. In 1980, early 80s, he went to Salvador and other parts of Latin America and Central America, and began to understand that U.S. policy in Central America was in some ways a replay of what had happened in Vietnam. And his ideas were gradually emerging. And then when he and I became friends and we started talking about history, then his ideas took shape much more. And you know, these are the kind of ideas that I've been doing for a long time, and Oliver's evolving in that way. Because Oliver comes from a very different kind of family than I did. My family was New York, intellectual, progressive, liberal, anti-war, pro-civil rights. Oliver's family is very, very conservative. His father was on Eisenhower's staff in Paris. His father went to Wall Street. His father was strongly anti-communist, pro-Cold War. And Oliver grew up with this extremely negative image of the Soviet Union. And when Oliver went to Yale in 1964, he was ironically in the same class as George W. Bush. Oliver was a Goldwater Republican. Probably he was to the right of George W. Bush in 1964 when he started at Yale. So he's made, in certain ways, much more of a migration toward this position, toward this view of history. And I have, my ideas have certainly evolved and matured as I've learned more and I studied history and I wrote about these topics. But Oliver has gone from the right wing of the political spectrum to very much on the left wing of the political spectrum. We don't see eye to eye entirely on every issue, but we certainly are very, very close on almost every issue.
You know, as an historian, the question of the importance of history often comes up, and then there's the old adage that, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it, which is certainly very true. But I'm wondering why you think the history of the United States over this the 20th century is particularly important now. Given that, you know, many observers are saying that the American empire is currently in decline, and of course a lot of empires have been ripped apart and caused a lot of havoc and misery as they do decline. What about America today motivated you to put all this work into this particular project so that more Americans would understand the darker side of their history?
I think you're making a good point about the American empire being in a state of decline objectively from the outside. That seems to be very, very true. The fact that the United States really has done very, very poorly in its attempts to expand the empire from militarily. After World War II, we have the Korean War, which was at best a standoff. Vietnam was a debacle. We were defeated there by what Kissinger refers to as a fourth-rate peasant army. If we look more recently, we had some victories in there. Of course, Reagan was very proud of our victory in Operation Urgent Fury against a couple dozen Cuban construction workers in Grenada. But, you know, we haven't really had very resounding military victories. The situation in Iraq and Afghanistan would hardly be, by any sane standard, considered a victory. The overall cost, according to Stiglitz and Bilmes, of the war on terror really is coming to $4 trillion. And what have we accomplished? I mean, the insanity in Afghanistan, as one lecturer at the Army War College, Lacey, said, we were spending the equivalent of $1.5 billion per per Al-Qaeda member in Afghanistan per year. So it's just insane the kind of policies we've pursued. But that, in some ways, gets at the heart of your question, I think. The fact that the United States is an empire in decline doesn't make it less dangerous. In many ways, it makes it more dangerous, because we're an empire that still has thousands of nuclear weapons, a couple thousand deployed, but we're an empire that is still trying desperately to maintain its hegemony and its control and the advantages that the United States has geopolitically against other countries. If we look at some of the recent steps that are most ominous, in November of 2011, Hillary Clinton had her article in Foreign Policy magazine titled America's Pacific Century, calling for the Asia pivot, that the United States has got to rebalance its forces from 50-50, our naval force from 50-50 Atlantic-Pacific now to 60-40 Pacific to Atlantic, that the United States is militarizing the situation across Asia right now in an effort to contain China in many of the same ways it once tried to contain the Soviet Union, the same conceptual apparatus, the same kind of approach that the United States had taken toward the Soviet Union with Kennan's containment doctrine we're seeing now in Asia, where we're doing these joint military exercises with various Asian nations. We're trying to get the Asian countries to increase their military spending and to isolate China. Again, we haven't really learned the new trade arrangements, the TPP that the United States is pushing, exclude China. So the same kind of attitude for containing and boxing in China rather than reaching out in a more friendly fashion. And how is China reacting? In some ways, just as badly as the Soviet Union reacted in the 1940s and 1950s with its repression in Eastern Europe. China is not repressing in quite the same way, but it's repressing in its own Chinese ways. And this hardline policy that we see that Chinese taking in the East and South China Sea conflicts is also exacerbating tensions. So you've got the new right-wing government in Japan, you've got a hardline government in Beijing, and that situation is really ripe for kind of dangerous confrontations. Not to go on too long about this, but some of the recent studies, I just got back from a West Coast trip that Oliver Stone and Dan Ellsberg and I did several events together. And Dan was making a very important point about the threat of nuclear, what we call nuclear fall or nuclear autumn. Not quite nuclear winter, but we've come very close to a nuclear war between India and Pakistan. What most people don't realize is that even a small portion of their arsenals have been set off, 50 bombs, that would not have been enough perhaps to trigger nuclear winter, but there are studies now showing that even a small, limited nuclear war could trigger nuclear famine or nuclear autumn, which would mean a billion dead over the next few years. That could cost a billion lives. The bar, the threshold for actual nuclear winter that could end life on the planet is much, much lower than people had realized earlier based on these studies. So there's a lot coming out, which makes an empire in decline in some ways as dangerous as an empire at the height of its power.
Thank you for that, Peter. I'll just reintroduce you to our audience. We're speaking tonight with Peter Kuznick. He's co-author, along with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone, of the book The Untold History of the United States, companion to the 10-part, actually a 12-part Showtime film series of the same title. Peter, there's important information in the film series, in the book, regarding the nuclear arms race from the time of World War II, when the U.S. bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, to the present. But I wondered if you talk about the importance of the figure of Henry Wallace, because there's a lot of information there I think many Americans are not aware of, the kind of change of history we had when he was not selected for a particular position. But maybe you can briefly sketch out Henry Wallace and the role he may have played in history had he been elected to higher office.
Yes, happily. Yeah, one of the sad things, I know this from my own students, I know this from the public speaking I do, Henry Wallace has been lost to history. He was an extraordinary man who's been really written out of the history books, been whitewashed. And that's a tragedy. He's also a lightning rod. A lot of the criticism that we get from the right wing has focused on our heroic portrait of Henry Wallace. The right wingers consider him to be a communist dupe. But we have a very, very different view of Wallace. Wallace comes from a leading farm family from Iowa. His father was Secretary of Agriculture for the Harding and Coolidge administrations, and Roosevelt tapped him to be Secretary of Agriculture for the first New Deal administration. Wallace served two terms as Secretary of Agriculture, and in 1940, when Roosevelt was looking for a running mate, knowing that we were on the verge of war against Germany and possibly Japan at that point, certainly war against fascism, he wanted Henry Wallace on the ticket because he wanted a leading, outspoken anti-fascist, and Wallace represented that, one of the leaders in the country, anti-fascist, anti-racist. But the party convention, the party bosses, didn't trust Wallace. He was much too radical. He had only become a Democrat in 1936, and they didn't trust him. They didn't want to put him on the ticket. Roosevelt wrote an extraordinary letter to the Democratic Party convention in which he turned down the nomination for the presidency for a third term. He said, "We already have one Wall Street money-dominated party. If the Democratic Party isn't the party of principle standing for social justice, liberal ideas, progressive ideas, then it has no reason to exist, and he's not going to run as president." Eleanor Roosevelt fortunately went to the floor of the convention and convinced the delegates that he was serious, and they put Wallace on the ticket as vice president. Wallace lived up to expectations. In 1941, Henry Luce declared the 20th century will be the American century. Luce was the head of the Time Life Empire, and he called for an American century in which the United States would dominate the world in every way. Wallace countered that as vice president. In his speech, he said that the 20th century must become the century of the common man. He called for a worldwide people's revolution in the tradition of the American, the French, the Latin American, and the Russian revolutions. He said we have to end monopolies and cartels, we have to end colonialism and imperialism and economic exploitation, and spread the fruits of science and industry around the world much more equitably. He went on later to say, to denounce America's fascists, who he said are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the nation comes second. So he obviously had a lot of enemies. The British and the French hated him for his attacks on their colonialism. The Southern segregationists hated him because he was the leading spokesperson for African-American civil rights. The sexists hated him because he was the leading spokesperson for women's rights and equality. The conservatives hated him. The Wall Street hated him. And he was also the leading spokesperson for labor rights. So he had his enemies, and the party bosses in 1944, knowing that Roosevelt was sickly and not going to survive another term, waged a campaign, which they called Pauley's Coup, to try to get Wallace off the ticket as vice president in 1944. Pauley was the party treasurer, California oil millionaire, who said he went into politics when he realized it was cheaper to elect a new Congress than to buy up the old one. And so they surrounded Roosevelt, and they set up the convention in such a way that it was rigged for Truman. Truman was rather a nonentity at the time. Now he's considered a near-great president. In 1944, that wasn't the case. He'd been elected to the Senate in 1934 when he ran for the first time, and Pendergast, the boss who ran Kansas City, the party boss in Kansas City, was asked why they chose Harry Truman to run for the Senate, and Pendergast says, "I wanted to show the world that a well-oiled machine could take a petty clerk and get him elected to the Senate." And his first term, Truman was shunned. They called him the senator from Pendergast, and none of the senators would even deal with him. He does better in his second term. He barely gets reelected. Pendergast is in prison, so Truman can't turn to him. So he turns to Hannigan, who ran the Hannigan-Dickman machine in St. Louis, and they finally got him reelected in 1940. But in 1944, at the convention, Wallace was probably the second most popular man in America, but the party had rigged it against him. The night the convention began, July 20th, 1944, Steamy Night in Chicago, Chicago Coliseum, Gallup releases a poll asking potential Democratic voters who they want on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Wallace back as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. So the party bosses thought they had the convention rigged, but that first night, Wallace gives a seconding speech for Roosevelt. The place goes wild in a spontaneous demonstration led by people like Hubert Humphrey and Adlai Stevenson. And in the midst of this, it goes on for almost an hour, in the midst of this demonstration, Claude Pepper, the senator from Florida, realizes that if he could get Wallace's name and nomination that night, he'll sweep the convention, be back on the ticket, defy the bosses. So Pepper fights his way through the crowd, gets up toward the front. The party bosses see what's happening, led by Mayor Kelly of Chicago. They start screaming to adjourn the convention immediately. There's a fire hazard, they say. The Sam Jackson, who was chairing the session, said, "I have a motion to adjourn. All in favor say aye." Maybe 5% said aye. All opposed said nay. Overwhelming majority say nay. Jackson says the motion carried. Claude Pepper was literally 5 feet from the microphone. Had he gotten those 5 feet to the microphone, Oliver and I contend that he would have been not only back on the ticket as vice president, he would have become president on April 12, 1945, when Roosevelt tragically dies. Had he become president instead of Truman, we're almost certain there would have been no atomic bombing in 1945, and there very possibly could have been no Cold War, or at least it would have taken a very, very different form than it did. Wallace stays on after he's ousted as vice president, and finally in the third ballot, Truman prevails after all the deals kick in. But if Wallace stayed on, Roosevelt begged him to stay on. He stayed on as Secretary of Commerce, and from inside the cabinet, he waged an internal battle for the mind of Harry Truman to try to convince him not to pursue his hostile policies toward the Soviet Union and not to pursue a nuclear arms race. And he stayed in there for about a year, and then in September of 1946, after Wallace made a very important speech at Madison Square Garden, Truman dropped him or fired him as Secretary of Commerce. And that was really, in my view, the last chance we had for averting the Cold War. And the rest of that was a disastrous and unfortunate history.
Well, I think that's certainly a chapter in our history that many people listening are not aware of those details in the important role that Wallace played and certainly could have played in the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union and the horrendous cost of the Cold War that might have been averted. Peter, I before we go, I wanted to maybe just revisit one other part of the book and the series that talks about Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, and particularly Reagan, and how he set the template of the modern Republican Party as the party of the wealthy that engendered a lot of race hatred and conflict within the society, corporate deregulation that laid the groundwork for horrendous economic policies and recession and unemployment and certainly the housing foreclosure epidemic we recently saw. But maybe you could talk a bit about how Ronald Reagan in particular set up the Republican Party as this extreme right-wing ideological party, very different from its predecessor.
Actually, the difference between Nixon and Reagan is quite remarkable. Nixon did not want to undermine and destroy the welfare state. Nixon did not have an attitude, for all of his faults, and we catalog them in great detail, especially in Vietnam, but beyond that as well. Nixon actually expanded the welfare state in many ways. Nixon set up OSHA. He set up the EPA. Nixon actually supported a guaranteed annual income. Can you imagine that in the United States? If Obama proposed a guaranteed annual income for everybody in this country, he'd be derided as a communist. You know, he was for his moderate policies. So Nixon, in many ways, in terms of domestic policy, would be to the left of Barack Obama, sadly. Reagan was very different. In fact, many of the right-wingers in the party wanted to get rid of Ford and replace him with Reagan in 1976. They wanted a real right-winger in there, not a Gerald Ford, who they considered to be much too moderate. A lot of those people trace back to this Committee on the Present Danger and other right-wing attempts in the previous years. The Reagan, we've got this image of Reagan now as this shining face who brought back American confidence and American optimism. As you suggest, we approach Reagan in the context of the ascendancy of the extreme dark right wing in the United States. We focus on a lot of these issues, of course, all of the deregulatory policies. One of our antagonists, Sean Wilentz at Princeton University, wrote a book about Reagan and the aftermath, in which he's got a very moderate portrait of Reagan, giving Reagan credit for a lot of things. We don't give Reagan very much credit for much of anything. From the standpoint of him being somebody whose ignorance and laziness was astounding, somebody who knew very, very little, somebody who took every hardline anti-Soviet position imaginable. Heats up the Cold War in an unconscionable way in the early 1980s and heats up the nuclear arms race and begins in intervening in situations that were very, very dangerous. People might remember what we did under Reagan in terms of Central America. I remember, among other things, when Reagan talked about the Contras in Nicaragua as the moral equivalents of the Founding Fathers. These murderers, torturers, rapists were compared to the Founding Fathers of the United States. I actually introduced a resolution into the Organization of American Historians back then in the 80s as a graduate student, which denounced Reagan for comparing the Founding Fathers to the Contras, which passed overwhelmingly through the Organization of American Historians. What we do in our documentary and in the book is catalog the horrors and the atrocities. But the other thing that we did during this time was intervene very heavily against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Now, it requires a lot of history and background, but the United States, in many ways, you can say that Carter began some of these programs, in which we're very, very critical of Carter for some of what he did in the last 2 years of his administration, but Reagan took it to a real extreme. And we started pouring money into Afghanistan, CIA and other funds, and we trained the Mujahideen. We trained these extreme fanatics. And what was their objection to the pro-Soviet government in Afghanistan? Their objection was that this government, one of the main objections with this government, was giving rights to women, that they were actually educating women. The people we were supporting were furious that the government was educating women. These were the most ruthless and bloody people. They would go in there and skin teachers alive who had the audacity to be teaching women in the classes. These were the people we were supporting, our freedom fighters in Afghanistan, the most reactionary, brutal group, many of whom later blow back on us, because among the people who were going to those camps that we were funding were Osama bin Laden and other terrorists who then, after Afghanistan, go and deploy around the rest of the world and blow back on us on 9/11. So the fruits of these Reagan policies, domestic policies, in terms of the deregulation that we see that you were talking about, beginning with the deregulation of the airlines and other kinds of deregulation of the banking system, undermining all the New Deal protections we had, and their foreign policy created the nightmare vision that began as America moved steadily to the right toward this dystopian society that began to emerge. And so that was the Reagan vision, and we have quite a bit on that because it's so important to debunk the myth of Reagan as this beloved figure, a centrist figure who brought back American confidence. So we're obviously very, very critical of Reagan.
And rightly so, given, as you said, from Central America to fueling the resurgence of Islamic fundamentalism indirectly leading to 9/11 and the current war on terrorism, I think there are way too many people in this country that aren't aware of Reagan's legacy, his actual legacy, as opposed to, as you said, this kind of the guy who restored America's greatness. So thank you for that, Peter.
As you're saying, we fanned the flames of the Islamic fundamentalism. Casey, when he was head of the CIA, was very, very proud of that. We actually began deploying them inside the Soviet Union in order to undermine and disrupt the Soviet Union. So that, and Brzezinski took a lot of credit for this earlier under Carter, and he said he was very glad when he said that what we were doing was going to force the Soviets to intervene, and we went ahead and did that. because he said, now we've given the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. That was a very deliberate policy of provocation, and now we're paying the price for it.
Peter Kuznick is our guest, co-author, along with Academy Award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone, of the book The Untold History of the United States, companion to the Showtime 10-part series of the same title. Another two chapters will be coming out in that series as well, in a box set that's going to be released this summer, right, Peter?
Yes, this summer.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that, leading right up to Obama's second term, so that's quite exciting. You guys are hard at work, I'm sure, still on that. Just to conclude here, Peter, I wondered, as you talk about this project that you did with Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States, in speaking engagements and in your classroom, what is the importance, you think, for particularly young people who may not be aware of this history that you and Oliver Stone bring out, because this is not in the textbooks that people are given in grade school and high school, and certainly many universities don't feature a lot of this darker side of the American empire.
Yeah, although there's much more of this at the universities than there is in the public schools. You know, we've got two problems. One is that Americans know very little of their own history. And second is that what they do know is largely wrong. The National Report Card, issued in 2011, reported that high school seniors are weakest in U.S. history. In fact, high school students in the United States come in lower in their scores on U.S. history than they do in math and science. We're always bemoaning the fact that Americans are so far behind in math and science. They're actually worse and more ignorant in terms of the U.S. history. 12% were considered proficient in U.S. history. Not outstanding, proficient. And of that 12%, only 2% were able to explain what the Brown versus Board of Education decision was about, even though the answer was implicit in the question itself. So we've got a serious problem in educating. Americans just don't know their history. And the younger generation knows it even less than the older generation. So you could say in many ways they're less tied to these Cold War shibboleths that the older people might have grown up with. They are still, what they're learning is often the exact opposite. It's the official history, the orthodox history, the flag-waving history. We're challenging this notion of American exceptionalism. We see it as very dangerous, the idea that the United States is God's gift to humanity, that the United States is different from all other countries. All other countries are motivated by greed, by lust, by desire for wealth, for territory, for economic expansion, and that the United States is different. The United States is only motivated by altruism and generosity and benevolence. We only want to spend freedom and democracy. That's a very, very dangerous view, and to the extent Americans hold to that view, we're going to keep on getting ourselves involved in these terrible quagmires and committing war crimes around the planet. People have to realize, in 1948, George Kennan, who was the head of the timeline, George Kennan, who was the leading architect of America's Cold War policy in that point, writes a secret memo and says that the United States is perhaps 6% of the world's population, yet we control 50% of the world's resources. Said in order to do so and to continue doing so, we're going to have to give up any idealistic notions. We're going to have to deal with truth, and we're going to have to deal with the reality of the economic situation, and push our own interests around the world, not act idealistically if we're going to maintain that imbalance in the distribution of the world's wealth. And that's what's happened repeatedly over and over again. Right now, the richest 300 people in the world have more wealth than the poorest 3 billion. That's the sad reality that we confront at this point in world history. Maybe we're making some progress. That China and India seem to be bringing people out of poverty. But overall, the legacy of the Pax Americana, the American empire, is not going to be looked at as a very, very positive one. But we'd like to see the United States change that when we still have time. We'd like to see the United States live up to its highest ideals, its best sense of itself, the idea that the United States actually can help bring peace and enlightenment instead of helping militarize the globe. We still have some 700 to 1,000 bases around the world. We don't know how many, in addition to the 6,000 in the United States. We're still responding militarily to situations in which there is no military solution. And I think we should have learned that lesson by now, and that's what Oliver and I are trying to convey in this. And we think that students understanding their history is the first step, because so long as they have this false notion of history, a mythical notion of history, an exceptionalist notion of history, they're not going to have the intellectual tools to make the changes that we see as necessary.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for spending time with us today talking about this important work, both the film series with Oliver Stone and the book written with Oliver Stone titled The Untold History of the United States. And we'll be looking forward to the two remaining chapters in the film series that will be released this summer with the box set of the Showtime film series. And certainly you're continuing on in the great tradition of Howard Zinn and other historians who have tried to acquaint people with the truth of our history rather than the cheerleading and the kind of sugar-coated history that is all too often what many people believe in and react to in terms of how they vote and their political persuasion. So thanks so much, Peter. Appreciate your time here.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.